story. He had great success in a big law firm in Tampa, but burned out at the age of 50 and tried retirement. He moved to Atlantic Beach, got a divorce, got bored, and decided to hang out his shingle. He's in his 60s now, happy in his little office, where he puts in a few hours here and there and chooses his clients carefully. We go through my biography, and I, for the most part, stick to the script. A couple of ex-wives in Seattle and so forth. I add my own new wrinkle of being a fledgling screenwriter who is polishing up my first script. With a lucky break here and there, the script has been optioned by a small production company that does documentaries. For various business reasons, I need to establish a small front in Florida. For $2,500, Murray can build a few firewalls. He'll set up an LLC, Limited Liability Company, in Florida, with M.R. Baldwin as the sole owner. The LLC will then form a corporation in Delaware, with Murray as the sole incorporator and me as the sole owner. The registered address will be his office, and my name will appear in none of the corporate documents. He says, "I do this all the time. Florida attracts a lot of folks who are trying to start over." If you say so, Murray. I could do this myself online, but it's safer to route it through a lawyer. The confidentiality is important. I can pay Murray to do things the shadows will never suspect and be unable to trace. With his seasoned guidance, Skelter Films comes to life. 2.5 months after the arrest of Quinn Rucker, and 2 weeks after I move into my beachfront condo, I am informed over coffee one morning by Diana that the feds would like to have a meeting. There are several reasons for this, the most important being their desire to update me on their case and talk about the trial. They want to plan my testimony. I am certain they also want to get a good look at Max Baldwin, who, by the way, is an improvement over Malcolm Bannister. The swelling is gone. The nose and chin are a bit sharper. The eyes look much younger. And the round red tortoiseshell glasses give the look of a pretty cool, cerebral documentary filmmaker. I shave my face once a week, so there is always some stubble, with just a touch of gray mixed in. The slick scalp requires a razor every other day. My cheeks are flatter, primarily because I ate little during my recovery and I've lost weight. I plan to keep it off. All in all, I look nothing like my former self, and while this is often unsettling, it is also comforting. The suggestion is that I return to Roanoke to meet with Stanley Mumphrey and his gang, but I flatly say no. Diana assures me that the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office do not know where I'm hiding, and I pretend to believe this. I do not want to meet them in Florida. After some haggling, we agree to meet at a hotel in Charleston, South Carolina. Diana books our tickets, and we fly out of Jacksonville on the same flight, but nowhere close to each other. From the moment we walk into the lobby of the hotel, I know I'm being watched and probably photographed. The FBI can't wait to see how I look. I catch a couple of quick glances, but keep moving. After a sandwich in my room, I meet Diana in the hallway, and we walk to a suite 2 floors above us. It is well guarded by 2 thick boys in black suits who appear ready to begin firing away at the slightest provocation. As a marshal, Diana has no role in the prosecution. Therefore, she remains outside with the 2 Dobermans while I enter and meet the gang. Stanley Mumphrey has brought 3 of his assistants, and their names are lost in the deluge of introductions. My pal, Agent Chris Hansky, is back, no doubt to eyeball me for a good before and after. He has a sidekick, name instantly forgotten. As we awkwardly take seats around a small conference table, I can't help but notice amid the pile of papers a couple of identical photos. It's Malcolm Bannister, and these guys were looking at him. Now they're gawking at Max. The transformation impresses them. Since Hansky is the only one who actually met me before the change, he goes first.
I gotta say, Max, you look younger and fitter. Not sure you're that much cuter, but all in all, not a bad makeover.
He's jovial, and this is supposed to break the ice. That means so much, I say with a fake smile. Stanley holds the copied photo and says,
Not even close, Max. No one would suspect you and Malcolm are the same. It's pretty remarkable.
We're all on the same team now, so we banter back and forth like old friends. But there's no foundation, so the conversation begins to lag. Is there a trial date? I ask, and this changes the mood.
Yes, Stanley says. October 10, in Roanoke.
That's only 4 months away, I reply. Seems pretty quick.
We're pretty efficient in the Southern District, Stanley says smugly. The average is 8 months from indictment to trial. This case has a bit more pressure behind it.
Who's the judge?
Sam Stillwater, on loan from the Northern District. All of Fawcett's colleagues in the Southern recuse themselves.
Tell me about the trial, I say. Stanley frowns, as does the rest of the gang.
It might be rather brief, Max. Not a lot of witnesses. Not a lot of proof. We'll establish Rucker was in the vicinity at the time. We'll prove he had a lot of cash when we caught him. We'll go into the prosecution of his nephew, the sentencing by Judge Fawcett. Maybe there was a revenge element at work.
Stanley pauses here, and I can't resist a jab. Pretty overwhelming stuff, I say like a smartass.
No doubt. Then we have the confession, which the defense has attacked. We have a hearing next week before Judge Stillwater, and we expect to win and keep the confession. Other than that, Max, the star witness might just be you.
I've told you everything. You know my testimony.
Right, right. But we want to cover it again.
Now that we've filled in a few gaps, let's nail it down to perfection.
Sure.
How's my buddy Quinn holding up?
Quinn's not doing too well these days. He doesn't like solitary confinement, or the food, the guards, the rules. Says he's innocent.
What a surprise.
I think he misses the good life at the Federal Country Club.
So do I. This gets a light laugh or two.
His lawyer convinced the judge that Quinn needed a psychiatric evaluation. The doctor said he can stand trial but needs some antidepressants. He's quite moody and often goes days without speaking to anyone.
That sounds like the Quinn I knew. Does he mention me?
Oh, yes. He doesn't like you either. He suspects you're our informant and that you'll testify against him at trial.
When do you have to submit your list of witnesses?
60 days before the trial.
Have you told Quinn's lawyer that I will testify?
No. We do not divulge anything until forced to do so.
That's the way I remember it, I say. These guys forget that I was once on the receiving end of a federal prosecution, with FBI agents sifting through every aspect of my life and a U.S. attorney's office threatening to incarcerate not only me, but my two innocent partners as well. They think we're pals now. One big, happy team walking lockstep toward another just verdict. If I could, I would knife them in the back and poison their case. They, the federal government, took away 5 years of my life, along with my son, my wife, and my career. How dare they sit here as if we're trusted partners? We eventually get around to my testimony and spend a couple of hours in review. This ground has been covered before, and I find it tedious. Mumphrey's chief assistant has a script, a Q&A for me to study. And I have to admit it's pretty good. Nothing has been left out. I try to visualize the surreal setting of my testimony. I will be brought into the courtroom wearing a mask. I will sit behind a panel or a partition of some manner that will prevent the lawyers, the defendant, and the spectators from seeing my face once the mask is removed. I will look at the jurors. The lawyers will pitch questions over the wall, and I will answer, my voice distorted. Quinn and his family and their thugs will be there, straining for any hint of recognition. They'll know it's me, of course, but they'll never see my face. As certain as it seems, I seriously doubt if it will ever happen. Chapter 24. Diana calls with the news that she has in her possession my new Florida driver's license and my new passport. We meet for coffee at a Waffle House and she hands them over. I give her an itinerary with a lot of gaps in it. "Taking a trip, huh?" she says, gazing at it. "Yep. I can't wait to try out the new passport. The first 3 nights are in Miami, South Beach, beginning tonight. I'm leaving and driving down as soon as my coffee cup is empty. From there, I'll fly to Jamaica for a week or so, then to Antigua, and maybe Trinidad. I'll call you at each stop. I'll leave my car at the Miami airport so you can tell the FBI exactly where it is. And while you're at it, ask them to please leave me alone while I bounce around the Caribbean." "Leave you alone?" she asks, feigning ignorance. "You heard me. Let's not play games here, Diana. I may not be the most heavily protected witness in the country, but I'm probably in the top three. Somebody's always watching. There's one guy, I call him Crew Cut, who I've seen 5 times in the past 2 weeks. He's not very good. So please pass this along to the Fibbies when you make your report. 6 feet even, 180 pounds, Ray-Bans, blonde goatee, drives a Cooper and sports a crew cut. Really, really sloppy. I'm surprised." So is she. She keeps her eyes on my itinerary and can think of nothing to say. Busted. I pay for the coffee and hit the road. Interstate 95 straight south for 350 miles. The weather is hot and muggy, the traffic heavy and slow, and I love every mile of the trip. I stop frequently to refuel, to stretch my legs, and to watch for movements behind me. I expect none. Since the FBI knows where I'm going, they won't bother with a tail. Besides, I assume there is a GPS tracking monitor brilliantly hidden somewhere in my car. 7 hours later, I stop in front of the Blue Moon Hotel, one of the many small renovated boutique hotels in the heart of the Art Deco district at South Beach. I get my briefcase and small bag from the trunk, hand the keys to the valet, and walk into a scene from Miami Vice. Ceiling fans turn slowly as guests in white wicker chairs gossip and drink.
"Checking in, sir?"
the pretty girl asks.
"Yes. Max Baldwin," I reply. And for some reason, it is a proud moment. I
Mighty Max am drowning in more freedom than I can absorb at the moment. Plenty of cash, fresh papers that are legit, a convertible that will take me anywhere. It's almost overwhelming. But I am jolted back to life when a tall, tanned brunette strolls through the lobby. Her top is what's left of a string bikini and covers almost nothing. Her bottom is a sheer skirt that covers even less. I hand over a Visa card for the charges. I could also use either cash or a prepaid credit card, but since the Phibbies know where I'm staying, there's no need to be deceptive. I'm sure the Miami office has been notified, and there's probably a set of eyes not too far away. If I were really paranoid, I could believe that the FBI has already been in my room and perhaps hidden a bug or two. I get to my room, see no bugs or spooks, take a quick shower, and change into shorts and sandals. I go to the bar to check out the talent. I eat alone in the hotel cafe and catch the eye of a 40-ish woman who is dining with what appears to be a female friend. Later, back in the bar, I see her again, and we introduce ourselves. Ava, from Puerto Rico. We're having a drink when the band starts. Ava wants to dance, and though it's been years, I hit the floor with all the energy I have. Around midnight, Ava and I make it to my room, where we immediately undress and hop into bed. I almost pray the FBI has the room wired for even the meekest of sounds. If so, Ava and I give them an earful. I hustle out of the cab at a curb on 8th Avenue in downtown Miami. It's 9:30 a.m., already hot, and after a few minutes of brisk walking, my shirt is sticking to my back. I don't think I'm being followed, but I duck and dart just the same. The building is a squat 5-story box, so ugly you can't believe someone paid an architect to design it. But then I doubt if most of the tenants are cutting-edge companies. One happens to be called Corporate Registry Services, or CRS, a name so bland and innocuous that no one would ever know the company's business, and most people would not want to. CRS may be perfectly legitimate, but it attracts a lot of clients who are not. It's an address, a drop-off, a front, a phone answering service that a corporation can hire to buy some measure of authenticity. Since I have not called ahead, I kill an hour waiting for an account representative. Lloyd is his name, and he eventually leads me back to a small, stuffy office and offers me a chair across from his landfill of a desk. We chat for a few minutes as he scans the questionnaire I've filled out. "What is Skelter Films?" he finally asks. "A documentary film production company. Who owns it?" "Me. Incorporated in Delaware." "How many films have you made?" "None. Just getting started." "What are the chances of Skelter Films being around 2 years from now?" "Slim." He hears this shadiness all the time, and it doesn't faze him. "Sounds like a front." "That's pretty accurate. We require an affidavit in which you swear under oath that your company will not be engaged in criminal activities." "I swear it will not." He's heard this before, too. "Okay, here's how we operate. We provide Skelter with a physical address here in this building. When we get mail, we forward it to wherever you say. We provide a phone number, and all incoming calls will be handled by a live voice who will chirp whatever you want. 'Good morning, Skelter Films, how can I direct your call?' or something else. You got partners?" "No." "Any employees, fictional or otherwise?" "I'll have a few names, all fictional." "No problem. If the caller asks for one of these ghosts, our girl will say whatever you want. Sorry, he's filming on location, or whatever. You write the fiction, and we'll deliver it. As soon as we get a call, we notify you. What about a website?
I'm not sure about this, so I say, not yet.
What are the pros?
Lloyd shifts weight and leans on his elbows.
Okay, let's say Skelter is a legitimate company that will make lots of documentaries. If so, it will need a website for all the usual reasons: marketing, information, ego. On the other hand, let's pretend Skelter is a real corporation, but not a real film company. Maybe it's trying to just give that impression, for whatever reason. A website is a great way to bolster the image, to sort of fudge on reality. Nothing illegal, mind you. But we can establish a website with stock photos and biographies of your staff, your films, awards, ongoing projects, you name it.
How much?
$10,000.
I'm not sure I want or need to spend the money. Not at this point, anyway.
Let me ponder it, I say, and Lloyd shrugs.
How much for your basic registry services?
Address, phone, fax, and everything related is $500 a month, payable 6 months in advance.
You accept cash?
Lloyd smiles and says,
oh yes, we prefer cash.
No surprise there. I pay the money, sign a contract, sign the affidavit form promising to keep my activities legal, and leave his office. CRS boasts of 900 satisfied clients, and as I walk through the lobby, I can't help but feel as though I've joined some manner of underworld filled with shell companies, faceless crooks, and foreign tax evaders.
What the hell?
After two more nights with Ava, she wants me to go home to Puerto Rico with her. I promise to think about it, then slip away from the Blue Moon and drive to the Miami International Airport, where I park in long term and shuttle to the terminals. I pull out a credit card and my new passport and buy a one-way ticket to Montego Bay on Air Jamaica. The plane is packed. Half dark-skinned native Jamaicans and half pale white tourists headed for the sun. Before we take off, the lovely attendants are serving rum punch. The flight takes 45 minutes. On the ground, the customs agent takes far too long studying my passport, and I'm starting to panic when he finally waves me through. I find the bus to Rum Bay Resort, an all-inclusive, singles-only, fairly notorious stretch of topless beaches. For 3 days, I sit in the shade by the pool and ponder the meaning of life. From Jamaica, I fly to Antigua, in the Leeward Islands of the Eastern Caribbean. It's a lovely island, 100 square miles, with mountains and white beaches and dozens of resorts. It's also known as one of the world's friendlier tax havens these days. And this is one reason for my visit. If I wanted nothing more than a good party, I would have stayed in Jamaica. The capital is St. John's, a bustling town of 30,000 situated on a deep harbor that attracts cruise ships. I check into my room in a small inn on the edge of St. John's, with a beautiful view of the water, boats, and yachts. It's June, the off-season, and for $300 a night, I will eat like a king, sleep until noon, and relish the fact that no one knows who I am, where I came from, or anything about my past. Chapter 25. The freezer had been dismantled a month earlier, and Victor Westlake was settled back into his routine and office on the fourth floor of the Hoover Building in Washington. Though the murders of Judge Fawcett and Naomi Clary were technically solved, many doubts and questions remained. The most pressing issue, of course, was the validity of Quinn Rucker's confession. If the judge suppressed it, the government would be left with little proof with which to go forward. The murders were solved, but the case was not closed, at least in Westlake's opinion. He was still spending 2 hours each day dealing with it. There was the daily report on the business of Max Baldwin, his movements, meetings, phone calls, internet activity, etc. So far, Max had done nothing to surprise them. Westlake did not like the trip to Jamaica and beyond, but there was nothing he could do about it. They were watching as closely as possible. There was the daily report on Rucker's family. The FBI had obtained court approval to monitor phone conversations of D. Ray Rucker, Sammy Tallman Rucker, their sister Lucinda, and four relatives involved in the D.C. unit of their trafficking operation. On Wednesday, June 15th, Westlake was in a staff meeting when he was summoned to the phone. It was urgent, and within minutes he was in a conference room with technicians who were working quickly to prepare the audio. One of them said, "The call came to D-Ray's cell phone last night at 11:19. Not sure where it came from, but here it is. The first voice is D-Ray. The second is Sully. We have not yet identified Sully." Another technician said, "Here it is. D-Ray."
"Yeah."
"Sully."
"D-Ray. Sully here."
"D-Ray.
What you got?"
"Sully.
Got the snitch, man. Bannister."
"D-Ray."
"No shit, man."
"Sully."
"No shit, D-Ray."
"D-Ray."
"Okay. Don't tell me how, just tell me where."
"Sully."
"Well, he's a beach bum now, in Florida. Name is Max Baldwin. Lives in a little condo in Neptune Beach, east of Jacksonville. Seems to have some money. Taking it easy, you know. The good life."
"D-Ray."
"What's he look like?"
"Sully.
A different dude. Lots of surgery. But the same height. Down a few pounds. Same walk. Plus we got a fingerprint and a match."
"D-Ray."
"A fingerprint?"
"Sully.
Our firm is good. They followed him down the beach and saw him toss a water bottle in the trash. They picked it up, got a print."
"D-Ray."
"That is good."
"Sully.
Like I said."
"What now?"
"D-Ray." "Sit tight. Let me sleep on it." "He ain't going nowhere, right?"
"Sully.
No. He's a happy boy."
"D-Ray."
"Beautiful."
Westlake slowly fell into a chair, slack-jawed and pale, too shaken to speak for a moment. Then,
"Get me Twill."
A flunky disappeared, and while he waited, Westlake rubbed his eyes and contemplated his next move. Twill, the top assistant, arrived in a rush, and they listened to the tape again. For Westlake, it was even more chilling the second time around.
"How in the..."
Twill mumbled. Westlake was recovering. "Call Bratton at the Marshal Service."
"Bratton had surgery yesterday," Twill said. "Newcomb is in charge."
"Then get Newcomb on the phone. We can't waste time here."
"I've joined a gym, and I spend an hour there each day around noon, walking uphill on a treadmill and doing reps with light weights. If I plan to spend so much time on the beach, I need to look the part. After some steam and a long shower, I am dressing when the cell phone starts buzzing in the top of my locker. It's Dear Diana, and an odd time for her to be calling."
"Hello?" I say quietly, though the locker room is not busy.
"We need to talk,"
she says abruptly, the first ever hint that something might be out of place.
About what?
Not now. There are two FBI agents in the parking lot in a maroon Jeep Cherokee parked next to your car. They'll give you a ride.
And how exactly do you know where I am at this moment, Diana?
Let's discuss it later.
I sit in a folding chair. Talk to me, Diana. What's going on?
Max, I'm 10 minutes away. Follow orders, get in the Jeep, and I'll tell you everything I know as soon as I see you. Let's not do it over the phone.
Okay. I finish dressing and try to act as calm as always. I walk through the gym and smile at a yoga instructor I've been smiling at for a week now, and make my way to the front door. I glance outside and see the maroon Jeep parked next to my car. At this point, it's fairly obvious that something dreadful has happened. So I swallow hard and step into the blinding midday sun. The driver hops out and, without a word, opens a rear door. I ride for 7 minutes in complete silence until we park in the driveway of a quaint duplex cottage with a for rent sign in the front yard. It's a block from the ocean. As soon as the engine is turned off, both agents jump out and scan the periphery, as if snipers might be up there, just waiting. The knot in my stomach feels like a bowling ball. We make it inside without getting shot, and Diana is waiting.
Nice place you have here, I say.
It's a safe house, she replies.
Oh, okay.
And why are we hiding in a safe house in the middle of a perfectly fine day? A gray-haired man enters from the kitchen and thrusts out a hand.
Max, I'm Dan Rayner, U.S. Marshal, supervisor for this area.
We shake hands like old friends, and he's actually smiling as if we're about to have a long lunch.
A real pleasure, I say.
What's going on?
There are four of them. Rayner, Diana, and the two nameless FBI agents, and for a few seconds they're not sure of the protocol here. Whose territory? Who's included? Who stays and who leaves? As I've already learned, these cross-agency turf fights can be confusing. Rayner does the talking.
Max, I'm afraid there's been a breach. To put it bluntly, your cover has been blown. We have no idea how this happened.
I sit down and wipe my forehead.
Who knows what? I ask.
Rayner says,
We don't know much, but there are some folks flying in from Washington right now. They should be here in an hour or so. Evidently, the FBI picked up something last night from a wiretap. There was some chatter among the Rucker family, and the FBI heard it.
They know where I am.
They do. They know exactly where you're living.
We're very sorry about this, Max, Diana says, and I glare at her and her stupidity as if I could strangle her.
Gosh, that means so much, I say.
Why don't you just shut up?
I'm sorry. That's twice you've said that. Please don't say it again, okay? It means nothing. It's totally useless.
She's stung by my harshness, but I really don't care. My only concern right now is my own skin. The four people staring at me, along with their higher-ups and their entire government, are all responsible for the breach. Would you like some coffee? Diana asks meekly.
No, I'd like some heroin, I say.
They find this funny.
But then we could all use a laugh. Coffee is poured, and a platter of cookies makes the rounds. We begin the process of waiting. As surreal as it is, I begin thinking about where to go next. Rayner says they'll get my car after dark. They are waiting on a black male agent from the Orlando office who will be my double for the next day or so. Under no circumstances will I be allowed to return to my condo to live. And we haggle about how to retrieve my sparse belongings. The marshal service will take care of the lease and turn off the utilities. Rayner thinks I'll need a different vehicle. but I push back initially. The FBI agents leave and return with sandwiches. The clock seems to stop as the walls close in. Finally, at 3:30, Mr. Victor Westlake walks in the front door and says, "Max, I'm sorry." I do not stand, nor do I offer a hand to shake. The sofa is all mine. He has three other dark suits with him, and they scramble for kitchen chairs and stools. When everyone is introduced and seated, Westlake begins. "This is highly unusual, Max, and I don't know what to say. As of now, we have no idea where the breach occurred, and we may never find out." "Just tell me what you do know," I say. Westlake opens a file and pulls out some papers. "Here's the transcript of a phone conversation we caught last night between D. Ray Rucker and someone named Sully. Both were on cell phones. D. Ray was in D.C. Sully made the call from somewhere around here." I read the transcript while the rest of them hold their breath. It takes a few seconds. Then I place it on the coffee table. "How'd they do it?" I ask. "We're still working on it. One theory is that they used a private company to track you down. We monitor a handful of firms that specialize in corporate espionage, surveillance, missing persons, private snooping, and the like. These are ex-military types, ex-spies, and, I'm ashamed to say, a few ex-FBI agents. They're good, and they have the technology. For the right fee, they could gather a lot of information." "From where? From the inside?" "We don't know yet, Max. If you did know, you wouldn't tell me. You would never admit it if the breach was caused by someone within the government, the FBI, the Marshal Service, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Department of Justice, the Bureau of Prisons. Hell knows who else. How many people are plugged into this little secret, Mr. Westlake? Several dozen? Maybe more? Did the Ruckers find me because they picked up my scent? Or did they follow the FBI because the FBI was following me?" "I assure you there was no internal breach." "But you just said you don't know. Your assurances mean nothing at this point. The only certainty right now is that everyone involved will cover their ass and point fingers, starting right now." "I don't believe anything you say, Mr. Westlake. You or anybody else." "You have to trust us, Max. This situation is urgent, perhaps lethal. I trusted you until this morning. And look where I am now. There's no trust. Zero. We have to protect you until the trial, Max. You understand this. After the trial, we lose interest. But until then, we have to make sure you're safe. That's why we tapped the phones. We were monitoring the Ruckers, and we got lucky. We're on your side, Max. Sure, there was a screw-up somewhere, and we'll find out what happened. But you're sitting here in one piece because we were doing our jobs." "Congratulations," I say, and go to the bathroom. The real fight breaks out when I inform them I'm leaving witness protection. Dan Rayner rants about how dangerous my life will be if I don't allow them to scoop me up and deposit me 1,000 miles away, under yet another name. Too bad. I'll take my chances hiding on my own. Westlake begs me to stay with them. My testimony will be crucial at trial, and without it, there may be no conviction. I remind him repeatedly that they have a confession, and no federal judge is going to suppress it. I promise I'll show up for the trial. I argue that my life will be safer when only I know where I'm hiding. There are simply too many agents involved in protecting me. Rayner reminds me more than once that the Marshal Service has never lost an informant within its protection, over 8,000 and counting. and I repeatedly remind him someone will be the first casualty. Someone other than me. The discussion is often heated, but I'm not backing down. And all they can do is argue. They have no authority over me. My sentence was commuted and I'm not on parole. I agreed to testify and I plan to do so. My agreement with the Marshals Service plainly states that I can leave witness protection anytime I want. I'm leaving, I declare and get to my feet. Will you be so kind as to drive me back to my car? No one moves. Rayner asks, What are your plans? Why would I share my plans with you? What about the condo? I'll leave in a couple of days, then it's all yours. So you are leaving the area? Diana asks. I didn't say that. I said I'm leaving the condo. I look at Westlake and say, And please stop following me. There's a good chance someone is watching you as you watch me. Give me a break here, okay? That's not true, Max. You don't know what's true. Just stop following me, okay? Of course he does not say yes. His cheeks are red, and he's really pissed. But then again, this is a man who usually gets his way. I walk to the door, yank it open, and say, If you won't give me a ride, I'll just walk. Take him back, Westlake says. Thanks, I say over my shoulder and leave the cottage. The last thing I hear is Rayner calling out, You're making a big mistake, Max. I ride in the back seat of the Jeep as the same two agents chauffeur me in silence. In the parking lot outside the gym, I get out and say nothing. They drive away, but I doubt they go far. I get into my little Audi, put the top down, and go for a drive along the beach on Highway A1A. I refuse to look in the rearview mirror. Victor Westlake returned to Washington on a government jet. When he arrived in his office after dark, he was briefed on the news that Judge Sam Stillwater had denied the defense motion to suppress the confession of Quinn Rucker. While no great surprise, it was still a relief. He called Stanley Mumphrey in Roanoke and congratulated him. He did not inform the U.S. attorney that their star witness was about to leave witness protection and disappear into the night. Chapter 26. I sleep with a gun. A Beretta 9mm legally purchased by me and duly licensed by the state of Florida. I haven't fired a weapon in 20 years, since my days as a Marine, and I have no desire to start shooting now. It's resting on the cardboard box that passes as a nightstand beside my bed. Another box on the floor is filled with the possessions I need. My laptop, iPad, some books, a shaving kit, a Ziploc bag filled with cash, a couple of files with personal records, and a prepaid cell phone with unlimited minutes and a Miami area code. A cheap suitcase, one that will fit into the Audi's rather small trunk, is packed with my wardrobe and ready to go. Most of these items, the gun, the cell phone, the suitcase, were purchased recently just in case a quick exit became necessary. Well, said exit is now at hand. Before dawn, I load the car and wait. I sit on my terrace for the last time, sipping coffee and watching the ocean fade into pink, then orange as the sun peeks over the horizon. I've watched this many times and never grow tired of it. On a clear morning, the perfect sphere rises from the water and says, Hello. Good morning. What another fine day it's going to be. I'm not sure where I'm headed or where I'll end up, but I plan to be near a beach
so I can begin each day with such quiet perfection. At 8:30, I walk out of the condo, leaving behind a refrigerator half filled with food and beverages, a motley assortment of dishes and utensils, a nice coffee pot, some magazines on the sofa, and some bread and crackers in the pantry. For 46 days I lived here, my first real home after prison, and I'm sad to be leaving it. I thought I would stay longer. I leave the lights on, lock the door behind me, and wonder how many more temporary hiding places await me before I am no longer forced to keep running. I drive away and am soon lost in the heavy commuter traffic going west into Jacksonville. I know they're back there, but maybe not for long. 2 hours later, I enter the sprawl north of Orlando and stop for breakfast at a pancake house. I eat slow, read newspapers, and watch the crowd. Down the street, I check into a cheap motel and pay cash for one night. The clerk asks for some ID with a photo, and I explain that I lost my wallet last night in a bar. She doesn't like this, but she likes the idea of cash, so why bother? She gives me a key, and I go to my room. Working the Yellow Pages and using my prepaid cell phone, I eventually find a detail shop that can squeeze me in at 3 that afternoon. For $199, the kid on the other end promises to make my car look like a new one. Buck's Pro Shine is on the backside of a large assembly line car wash that's doing a bustling business. My car and I are assigned to a skinny country kid named Denny, and he takes his job seriously. In great detail, he lays out his plan for washing and shining, and is surprised when I say that I'll wait.
"Could take 2 hours," he says.
"I have nowhere to go," I reply. He shrugs and moves the Audi onto a wash rack. I find a seat on a bench under a canopy and start reading a Walter Mosley paperback. 30 minutes later, Denny finishes the exterior wash and starts the vacuum. He opens both doors and I ease over for a chat. I explain I'm leaving town, so the suitcase stays in the back seat and the cardboard box in the trunk is not to be touched. He shrugs again. "Whatever. Less work for him." I take a step closer and tell Denny that I'm going through a bad divorce and I have reason to believe my wife's lawyers are watching every move I make. I strongly suspect there is a GPS tracking device hidden somewhere in or on the car, and if Denny finds it, I'll slide him an extra $100 bill. At first, he is hesitant, but I assure him it's my car, and there's nothing illegal about disarming a tracking device. Her slimy lawyers are the ones breaking the law. Finally, there's a twinkle in his eye, and he's on board. I pop the hood, and together we start combing the car. As we do so, I explain there are dozens of different devices, all shapes and sizes, but most are attached with a strong magnet. Depending on the model, the battery can last for weeks, or the device can even be hotwired to the car's electrical system. Some antennas are external, some internal.
"How do you know all this?"
he asks, flat on his back, his head under the car poking around the chassis. "Because I hid one on my wife's car," I reply, and he finds it funny.
"Why haven't you looked for yourself?"
he asks.
"Because I was being watched."
We search for an hour and find nothing. I'm beginning to think maybe my car was bug-free after all, when Denny removes a small panel behind the right headlight. He's on his back, his shoulder squeezed against the right front tire. He snaps something loose and hands it to me. The waterproof covering is the size of a cell phone and made of hard black plastic. I remove it and say, "Bingo." I've looked at 100 of these online,
and have never seen one like this, so I assume it's government issued. No brand name, no markings, numbers, or letters. Nice work, Denny, I say, and hand him $100 bill.
Can I finish detailing now? He asks.
Sure. I drift away, leaving him to his labors. Next to the car wash, there is a small shopping center with half a dozen low-end stores. I buy a cup of stale decaf and sit in the window of a coffee shop, watching the parking lot. An elderly couple in a Cadillac park, get out, and shuffle into a Chinese buffet. As soon as they're inside, I exit the coffee shop and walk through the lot as if I'm headed to my car. Behind the Cadillac, I quickly bend over and slap the tracking device onto the bottom of the fuel tank. Ontario license plates. Perfect. Denny is washing windows, sweating profusely, lost in his work. I tap him on the shoulder, startle him, and say,
"Look, Denny, nice work and all, but something's come up. I need to hit the road."
I'm peeling off cash and hand him three $100 bills. He's confused, but I don't care.
"Whatever you say, man," he mumbles, staring at the money.
"Gotta run." He pulls a towel off the top of the car.
"Good luck with the divorce, man."
"Thanks." West of Orlando, I take Interstate 75 north, through Ocala, then Gainesville, then into Georgia, where I stop in Valdosta for the night. Over the next 5 days, my wanderings take me as far south as New Orleans, as far west as Wichita Falls, Texas, and as far north as Kansas City. I use interstate highways, state routes, country roads, and national parkways. All expenses are paid in cash, so to my knowledge, there is no trail. I double back a dozen times and become convinced there is no one behind me. My journey ends in Lynchburg, Virginia, where I roll in just after midnight and once again pay cash for a motel room. So far, only one place has refused to do business because I claim to have no ID. Then again, I'm not lodging at Marriott's or Hilton's. I'm tired of the road and eager to get down to business. I sleep late into the next morning, then drive an hour to Roanoke, the last place anyone who knows Max Baldwin would expect to find him. Fortified with that knowledge and a new face, I am confident I can move around with anonymity in a metro area of 200,000 people. The only troublesome part of my package is the Florida license plates on my car, and I contemplate renting another one. I decide against this because of the paperwork. Plus, the Florida angle will pay off later. I drive around the city for a while, checking out the landscape, downtown, the old sections, and the inevitable sprawl. Malcolm Bannister visited Roanoke on several occasions, including once as a 17-year-old high school football player. Winchester is just 3 hours north on Interstate 81. As a young lawyer there, Malcolm drove down twice to take depositions. The town of Salem adjoins Roanoke, and Malcolm spent a weekend there once at a friend's wedding. That marriage ended in divorce, same as Malcolm's. The friend was never heard from again after Malcolm went to prison. So I sort of know the area. The first motel I try belongs to a national chain and has rather strict rules about registration. The old lost wallet ruse fails me, and I am denied a room when I cannot produce an ID. No problem. There is an abundance of inexpensive motels in the area. I drift to the southern edge of Roanoke and find myself in a less than affluent part of Salem, where I spot a motel that probably offers rooms by the hour. Cash will be welcomed. I opt for the daily rate of $40 and tell the old woman at the front desk I will be around for a few days. She's not too friendly, and it dawns on me that she might have owned the place back in the good old days when blacks were turned away. It's 90 degrees, and I ask if the air conditioning is working. Brand new units, she says proudly. I park around back, directly in front of my room, and far away from the street. The bed linens and floors are clean. The bathroom is spotless. The new window unit hums along nicely. And by the time I unload my car, the temperature is below 70. I stretch out on the bed and wonder how many illicit hookups have occurred here. I think of Ava from Puerto Rico and how nice it would be to hold her again. And I think of Vanessa Young and what it will be like to finally touch her. At dark, I walk down the street and eat a salad at a fast food place. I'm down 20 pounds since I left Frostburg, and I'm determined to keep losing, for now anyway. As I leave the restaurant, I see stadium lights and decide to take in a game. I drive to Memorial Stadium, home of the Salem Red Sox, Boston's Class High A affiliate. They're playing the Lynchburg Hillcats before a nice crowd. For $6, I get a seat in the bleachers. I buy a beer from a vendor and soak in the sights and sounds of the game. Nearby is a young father with his two sons, T-ballers, I suspect, no more than 6 years old and wearing Red Sox jerseys and caps. I think of Bo and all the hours we spent playing catch in the backyard, while Dion sat on the small patio and sipped iced tea. It seems like yesterday that we were all together, a little family with big dreams and a future. Bo was so small and cute, and his father was his hero. I was trying to turn him into a switch hitter at the age of 5, when the feds entered my life and wrecked things. What a waste. And, other than myself, no one really cares anymore. I suppose my father and siblings would like to see my life made whole again. But it's not a priority. They have their own lives to worry about. Once you go to prison, the world assumes you deserve it, and all pity comes to an end. If you polled my former friends and acquaintances in my hometown, I'm sure they would say something like, "Poor Malcolm. He just crawled in bed with the wrong people, cut some corners, got a bit greedy. How tragic." Everyone is quick to forget because everyone wants to forget. The war on crime needs casualties. Poor Malcolm got himself captured. So, it's just me, Max Reed Baldwin. Free, but on the run. Scheming some way to exact revenge while riding off into the sunset. Chapter 27. For the sixth day in a row, Victor Westlake sipped his early morning coffee while scanning a brief memo on Mr. Max Baldwin. The informant had vanished. The GPS tracker had finally been removed from a Cadillac Seville owned by an elderly Canadian couple as they ate lunch near Savannah, Georgia. They would never know they had been cyber-tracked by the FBI for 300 miles. Westlake had punished the three field agents assigned to monitor Baldwin's car. They lost him in Orlando and picked up the wrong scent as the Cadillac headed north. Baldwin wasn't using his iPhone, his credit cards, or his initial internet service provider. The court-approved snooping on those fronts would expire in a week, and there was almost no chance it would be renewed. He was neither a suspect nor a fugitive, and the court was reluctant to allow such extensive eavesdropping on a law-abiding citizen. His checking account at Suncoast had a balance of $4,500.
The reward money had been tracked as it was split and bounced around the state of Florida, but the FBI eventually lost its trail. Baldwin had moved the money so fast, the FBI lawyers could not keep pace with their requests for search warrants. There were at least 8 withdrawals, totaling $65,000 in cash. There was one record of a wire transfer of $40,000 to an account in Panama, and Westlake assumed the rest of the money was offshore. He had grudgingly come to respect Baldwin and his ability to disappear. If the FBI couldn't find him, maybe he was safe after all. If Baldwin could avoid credit cards, his iPhone, use of his passport, and getting himself arrested, he could remain hidden for a long time. There had been no more chatter from the Rucker clan, and Westlake was still dumbfounded by the fact that a gang of narco-traffickers in D.C. had located Baldwin near Jacksonville. The FBI and the Marshals Service were investigating themselves, but so far, not a clue. Westlake placed the memo in a pile of papers and finished his coffee. I find the office of BB Security in a professional office building not far from my motel. The Yellow Pages ad boasted 20 years of experience, a law enforcement background, state-of-the-art technology, and so on. Almost all of the ads in the private investigation section use this same language, and I cannot remember, as I park my car, what attracted me to BB. Maybe it is the name. If I don't like the outfit, I'll go to the next name on my list. If I had seen Frank BB walk down the street, I could have said, "There goes a private detective." 50 years old, thick-chested with a gut pressuring his shirt buttons, polyester pants, pointed-toe cowboy boots, full head of gray hair, the obligatory mustache, and the cocky swagger of a man who's armed and unafraid. He closes the door to his cramped office and says, "What can I do for you, Mr. Baldwin?" "I need to locate someone." "What type of case?" he asks as he lands hard in his oversized executive chair. The wall behind him is covered with large photos and seminar certificates. "It's not really a case. I just need to find this guy." "What will you do after you find him?" "Talk to him. That's all. There's no cheating husband or delinquent debtor. I'm not looking for money or revenge or anything bad. I just need to meet this guy and find out more about him." "Fair enough." Frank uncaps his pen and is ready to take notes. "Tell me about him." "His name is Nathan Cooley. I think he also goes by Nat, too. 30 years old, single, I think. He's from a small town called Willow Gap."
"I've been through Willow Gap.
Last I knew, his mother still lives there. But I'm not sure where Cooley is now. A few years back, he got busted in a meth sting."
"What a surprise."
"And spent a few years in federal prison. His older brother was killed in a shootout with the police." Frank is scribbling away.
"And how do you know this guy?"
"Let's just say we go way back." "Fair enough."